Well, if you'll turn to Mark chapter 10, we begin another chapter of the gospel today. We'll take 12 verses, Mark 10, 1 through 12, and the subject is marriage and divorce. I want to read to you from R.C. Sproul's commentary on Mark. I thought this was an interesting introduction to a chapter he has on this subject, and I'll use it as an introduction to this sermon. This is what R.C. Sproul has written. In the mid-20th century, the Harvard sociologist Pyotr Sorokin wrote a book in which he sounded an alarm about the impending disintegration of American culture and civilization. The central concern of Sorokin's book was the radical proliferation of divorce and the breakup of the American home between 1910 and 1948. He pointed out that in 1910, 10% of U.S. marriages ended in divorce, but that number rose to 25% in 1948. Sorokin, speaking as a historian of culture, said that no civilization can long survive when one-fourth of its marriage units are disintegrating. Of course, the situation has only grown worse since Sorokin wrote. Now, the divorce rate in America is more than 50%. And many people who study these things have observed that within the professing church, the divorce rate is as high amongst professing Christians as it is among the rest of the culture as well. Many things we're going to look at today are not accepted outside of the church, but we are concerned about this subject because it's one of the subjects that God addresses, and so we want to know what He has said about it. First of all, we want to look at Jesus' itinerary as He continues in His travels here. So look at verse 1. This is Mark 10, verse 1. And He left there and went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to Him again. And again, as was His custom, He taught them. We want to remember now that Jesus is proceeding toward Jerusalem. The great Galilean ministry is ended. In fact, it's ended for some time now. And He has announced what's going to happen when He gets to Jerusalem, the events of the Passion. He has been instructing the disciples of His coming death and the resurrection to follow. We've seen that several times now already. The first time He announced this to them was in chapter 8, verse 31. Then in chapter 9, again verse 31. And He will announce it a third time. It's in this chapter, chapter 10, verses 33 and 34. I don't doubt that He spoke of this many other times as well to the disciples, but these three times He announces His coming death and resurrection. He's soon going to fulfill the mission for which He has come into the world. Remember the key verse of Mark's Gospel, chapter 10, verse 45. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give His life as a ransom for many, or in the place of many, His substitutionary death. So we want to look here at the route that He takes. Notice right at the beginning of verse 1, it says, He left there. Well, what is He referring to? Well, the last place that we have had mentioned is in chapter 9, verse 33. It says they came to Capernaum. So perhaps He has now left Capernaum. Remember, that's a city on the top of the Sea of Galilee, where so much had taken place. That's where He healed Peter's mother-in-law, did many miracles there, cast out many demons, preached there, preached in the synagogue. But He has left there now. and he is traveling south, traveling toward Jerusalem. He went down, it says, into the region of Judea. Perhaps he passed partly through Samaria. He's come down into Judea. And then it says, and beyond the Jordan. And that indicates to us then, at some point as he travels south, he crossed the Jordan River, and now he's now on the east side of the Jordan River in what is known as Transjordan, or also known as Perea. If you ever read a book that speaks of the Perean ministry of Jesus, well, it's what's happening only in chapter 10 here. Perea was that part of the geography that's on the eastern side of the Jordan River. It's south of the Decapolis. If you remember, we talked about the Decapolis. That was a federation of 10 Gentile states on the south side of the Sea of Galilee. I wish we had a map here that we could identify all these things, but the region of Decapolis, some significant things happened there. The feeding of the 4,000. This is where he cast the demon out of the man, the demon called Legion. And so he's south of that now. And another significant thing perhaps of this area on the eastern side of the Jordan River, this is where Herod Antipas governs. Remember him? He's the guy that put John the Baptist to death, had him executed. And so Jesus is proceeding down on the east side of the Jordan River in this area, but eventually before he gets down as far as the Dead Sea, he crosses back again to the western side, because look at verse 46. And they came to Jericho. So we know at that point he crossed the Jordan, because Jericho's on the western side, and that is, of course, where he did another of his miracles. In fact, I think this is the only time Mark records giving of sight to a blind man. If I remember right, it will be that particular passage there. And during this time, during this ministry, he's once again teaching the crowds, which he hasn't been doing too much of that recently, but he does once again teach the crowds, but his focus is still upon ministering to the disciples. All right, so he encounters some Pharisees, and they bring up a question that prompts this teaching, which we want to look at, on marriage and divorce. Let's go on with verse 2. And Pharisees came up, and in order to test him, asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away." Now, the first thing we want to note here is the Pharisees ask this question. They want to question Jesus about his views on divorce. They're not seeking truth. They're asking deceitfully. In fact, really, when Jesus asked them, "Well, what did Moses command you?" they knew immediately where to go. They knew Deuteronomy 24, that Moses allowed divorce, so they've even answered their own question, really. I think what we understand here is, because they're testing him, they're trying to set a trap for Jesus once again. They want to cause him harm if they can. And it's interesting, in the commentaries I've read, there's different views of what they have in mind, but I rather like this idea, that because they're in this region where Herod Antipas is the governing authority, remember Herod Antipas, what he had done, he had divorced his wife, he wanted to marry Herodias, who was his brother Philip's wife, so she divorced from her husband, and they came together in marriage. And John the Baptist went to him and said, "What you've done is not lawful." In fact, John saw this as a case of incest, in fact. And so you remember then that Herod Antipas retaliated by putting John in prison, and eventually he executed him. And it's possible that what the Pharisees are hoping is that Jesus will take a somewhat hard view here about divorce, and they can run over and tattle to the local authority, Herod Antipas. And maybe the same thing will happen to Jesus that happened to John the Baptist. You can imagine that they would be thrilled if something like that would take place. Now, let's spend a little time here looking at the controversy that was present among the Jews at this time based upon this Old Testament passage that they have in mind and Jesus has in mind. Let's turn back to Deuteronomy 24. I think it's, even though Jesus is going to really circumvent this, he's not concerned that much with what Moses wrote as in this passage, as what Moses wrote at the very beginning of Genesis. But it'd be helpful to look at this. So Deuteronomy 24, this is a passage that where he says, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce. Let me read Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, because this is what they all have in mind here. This is what Moses had written, a law concerning divorce. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. The main point in that whole passage is, well, what we have here is a man who has divorced his wife. She marries another man, but maybe he divorces her or he dies. The point is, the first husband cannot take her back again. He can never have her as his wife a second time. Perhaps the point is, Moses is writing, think twice before you divorce your wife, because if you have second thoughts about it, according to this law, you can never have her back again. But the main point that the Jews were interested in this portion is not that. It's what we find here in verse 1. He has divorced her because he has found some indecency in her. And the question that the Jews debated is, what did Moses mean by that? What was this indecency that might be found in the wife that would allow for divorce? And they debated this often. And there were two schools of thought on what Moses meant by the matter of some indecency in her, centered around two famous rabbis and what they had taught, Rabbi Shammai and Rabbi Hillel. And it is commonly said that Shammai took this view, that the indecency that Moses had in mind here that would be grounds for divorce was that this wife had committed adultery or some time of unchastity. Now, there's some question whether that was really true or not, where that was a view, but let's let it stand there. This was seen as the conservative view, the narrow view, rather unpopular among most of the Jewish men. They preferred rather the view of the other rabbi whose name was Hillel. And Hillel's teaching on this was that the indecency that is mentioned here was, it could be almost any offense that the husband felt that his wife had committed that would allow him to divorce her. And by the way, I might add this, which makes it seem all the more unfair. A Jewish man could divorce his Jewish wife. A Jewish wife could not divorce her Jewish husband. That's the way it worked. So perhaps the wife burned the food at a meal. According to Hillel, this was an indecency deserving of divorce. Or perhaps the wife had talked too loud in the house and the neighbors heard her. This, according to Hillel, was an indecency deserving of divorce. Or perhaps, as she got older, she got too many wrinkles on her face. This, according to Hillel, was an indecency deserving of divorce. And need I go on? All kinds of things. This, I have to say, was a popular view among many Jewish husbands. So just so we kind of know what was in men's minds here concerning this. But now we want to look at is Jesus' view on marriage. Let's go back now and look at verse 5. And Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What, therefore, God has joined together, let not man separate." So Jesus goes right back to the beginning, to Genesis. By the way, I thought I should mention this perhaps. As Jesus gives his view here, you realize he gives this view as an unmarried man. Jesus was not married, despite what certain heretics have been saying recently, that he was married to Mary Magdalene. That's heretical and ignorant. Jesus was not married, nor was the Apostle Paul married. Even though he gave some very specific instruction about marriage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But two of the persons we most admire in the Scripture, Jesus, of course, and Paul, the great apostle, were not married. And I just want to make this point. If you are single, if you are not married, if you prefer it that way, that's okay. We want to recognize that. To be married is a very good state to be in, and to not be married can be an equally good state. So I just thought I'd throw that out there because that's what we recognize within the church. Now, what Jesus does here in verse 5 is he shows that the teaching that Moses had given here about this matter of divorce was a concession. It was a concession made because of the hardness of men's hearts. Let me read that again in verse 5. Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment." You see, this concession of divorce was made because the husband then could not just simply put his wife out on the street, so to speak, just boot her out, just kick her out of the house. He had to give her proper divorce papers so that she could show, once again, that she's single, she's available, and she can be legally joined to a second husband. Remarriage in that culture was assumed. She's a vulnerable person. She has little opportunity to make a living on her own. So this was the concession that was made. A man might divorce his wife, but he couldn't just put her out like that. He had to give her divorce papers, which would prove that she could be joined to another man. But what Jesus does here in dealing with this issue of marriage and divorce, he goes back to the original ordination of marriage. And I thought maybe we'd read from Genesis 2, but I think we can just stick with what we have here because he's quoting from that. Let me just read it again as Jesus quotes from Genesis 2. It says, "From the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." And you can read the fuller account of that, of course, if you want to go back to Genesis 2 and read verses 18 through 24. Let me just make some points here about the marriage relationship from that passage. First of all, the husband and the wife are meant to complement one another in the marriage relationship. If you remember, and if you read that passage, you remember that Adam was alone and he needed a helper suitable to him to complement him. None of the animals was found to be such a suitable companion. And so what God did, he put Adam to sleep. He took a rib out of his body and fashioned a woman, Eve, to be his wife. And thus the two were to complement one another and supply one another's needs. A second thing, and this is so obvious, it hardly needs saying, but I guess I need to say it anyway. Marriage is ordained of God. Marriage is God's idea. God established it from the beginning. It's not something that some person or group of people dreamed up along the way as a good idea. And of course, we can imply from that, if God planned it and ordained it and established it, he knows how to govern it and make it function as well. And here's something that I think I need to add today in our culture and our society, sadly. Notice that it says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his what? His boyfriend? His man friend? Hold fast to his wife. Gay marriage is wrong. It's an abomination to God. The church must oppose it. Do you think the world will hate us for doing that? Yes. So what? We have to stand for what God is saying. This is one of the saddest abominations of our day, that the views on homosexuality and lesbianism and gay marriage have come to what they are. And then another point we should make from this is that as God saw in the original intent, it was to be permanent. Let's read on here now in verses 10 through 12. And in the house the disciples asked him again about this matter, and he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, Mark's words seem to leave no grounds for divorce. And of course, if there are no grounds for divorce, there would be no grounds for remarriage either. And in fact, that is the view of some churches. However, this passage doesn't give us some complete picture, because we find elsewhere that there is an exception clause that needs to be brought into this study. In fact, I would say there are two of them. So let's turn to Matthew's account of this passage now. If you'll turn to Matthew chapter 19, where we find what is called an exception clause. Actually, you'll find this twice in Matthew's gospel, once in chapter 5 and then in chapter 19. And I'm going to use the passage here in chapter 19 because what Matthew is giving us here is this same passage that Mark is giving us in chapter 10 of Mark. And I'm just going to pick it up here somewhere in, no need to read the whole passage, but we want to get down to verse 9 You can begin at Matthew 19, verse 1, but I'm going to just pick it up here, maybe verse 6. And Jesus is speaking again. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command one to give her certificate of divorce and to send her away? He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Now here's the verse 9, that has this exception clause. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. You can see the exception clause. Divorce is allowed if there has been sexual immorality. Now, don't ask me to explain why Mark didn't say this. I don't know. But it is in Matthew's account, and Jesus did say this. The words sexual immorality in my text here are the translation of one Greek word, which is pronounced porneia. We get the word pornography from that. It isn't the more common word for adultery. Sexual immorality or porneia, this word is a broader term than that. But the thing to notice that's so helpful for us, that Jesus does give an allowance for divorce here, and certainly it would include adultery. Now, here's a question that could be asked. And R.C. Sproul presents this in his chapter on this subject. And I think he's correct on this. But we could ask this question. What if has been adultery in a marriage? And what if the sinning partner repents and asks for forgiveness and wants to reconcile to the mate that they have sinned against? Must that marriage continue? Now here's what Sproul says. I would say I agree with him. He says, if the sinning partner in the marriage repents and asks for forgiveness, he must be forgiven. Anytime someone has sinned against us in any way, if that person repents and asks for forgiveness, we must extend forgiveness to them. But, he says, that does not necessarily obligate the one sinned against to reconcile. And not everybody will agree with that, perhaps, but I think he's probably right in that. And we might hope that there could be a reconciliation. And many times there is a reconciliation, but the one who has been sinned against is not obligated to reconcile. So there is this exception clause where divorce is permitted where there has been adultery. The other exception clause is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Let's turn to that. And once again, not everybody's going to agree on this exception clause. If you have the Reformation Study Bible and you want to look at the notes that are there. No, excuse me. I guess it was in Mark 10, verse 11. There's a note there you might want to look at where they do present these two exception clauses. The second exception clause has to do with desertion. That possibly if there has been desertion, this would give grounds for divorce as well. Without getting into the whole context of the passage, which would mean we'd need to study the whole chapter, but it does speak here of a believer who's married to an unbeliever, and the unbelieving partner, because of the faith in Christ, wants to leave, wants to separate, wants to divorce. That is to take place if necessary. It's verse 15 here. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, a brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. And to be honest with the passage, it doesn't address the matter of remarriage after the separation. These would be the only two grounds on which divorce could occur, where there's been unfaithfulness by the one partner in the marriage and the other where there's been desertion. Now let me read to you. I'm always really thankful when I can get some help with thorny issues like this, and this is a thorny one. Let me read to you from the Westminster Confession of Faith what was written there by some men who I'm sure thought very long and hard on this. There's a chapter here in the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 24 of Marriage and Divorce. Let me just read a portion of what they have here in verses or articles 5 and 6. In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent partner to sue out a divorce and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead. And I hear Joshua, we've heard Joshua's first comments, so too bad his first sermon has to be on such a difficult subject. Let me read that again, because it's dealing with that first exception clause. In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead. So that's dealing with that first exception clause, the opinion of those who wrote the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now let me read this because it deals with the second one as well. Although the corruption of man be such as is apt to study arguments unduly to put asunder those whom God hath joined together in marriage, yet nothing but adultery or such willful desertion as can no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate is cause sufficient of dissolving the bond of marriage. So they do seem to be endorsing both of these exception clauses, that divorce is allowed in the case of adultery or of desertion. That's my position. I agree. And again, this is such a difficult subject. Not all persons are going to agree on that. Not all pastors are going to agree on that. Not all churches are going to agree on that. In fact, this is just one of the most difficult subjects there is to deal with in church life. And of course, you know, you realize everything I'm saying here means nothing to the world. Most people in the world would just think this is off the wall stuff. But you see, we are concerned with what God has to say. We are concerned with God's view on this very important subject. Now let me say this, and you can read R.C. Sproul's note in the bulletin. It's a good note. I just think that every situation that deals with this subject has to be evaluated on its own merits and demerits. There's just no cookie-cutter approach to this difficult subject. Let me just suggest a possible counsel nightmare. Just imagine that you're the pastor and a married woman has come and she says, I just can't live with my husband anymore. I can't take anymore. I'm seeking a divorce, but I want to know what God's Word has to say to me on this subject. So upon examining the situation, really the husband's not having an affair. There's no one night stand or any of that. And he's coming home at night. He's paying the bills. There's no obvious desertion in that sense. But she says, I just can't take the beatings anymore. I can't take the verbal and the physical abuse. How many black eyes do I have to accept? How many bruises do I have to have on my body? How many times can he come home in a drunken rage and beat me up like this? What would you tell her as her pastor? By the way, this hasn't happened to me. I hope it never happens. It wouldn't happen with you folks, I'm sure, but I'll tell you what I would do first. I'd call the elders and ask them to get together with me. We could look this together. Can you see why many times when pastors are faced with that kind of a situation, they wonder just how far you can stretch desertion? What all can desertion cover? And I would just have to say, now I don't think any wife should have to stay in a marriage where she's treated this way. And what I have said on occasion is, whatever you decide, I'll back you up in it. Let me finally just say this, that the responsibility we have as Christians, the responsibility we have as a church, we're to be the salt of the earth. We're to be the light of the world. We need to live out marriage as God instructed us to, and indeed, He's given us good instruction in Genesis, in the epistles. Paul had a lot to say in Ephesians, Corinthians. So we really need to set an example to the rest of the world that's just going so far astray in this God-given institution of marriage. I really wonder sometimes how our nation can continue to survive in the direction it's going. How can a nation survive God's judgment where the legislation that comes down on all levels approves of abortions, where now we have increasingly states and a federal government that approves of gay marriage, and where marriage is failing so badly because, you see, families are the pillar of our society. Families are that most basic foundational unit that holds society together. And when marriages are failing at the rate of 50% or more, really, don't you wonder how long we can go on like this before things just completely come apart? But maybe because the church is here and we can be the light of the world and the salt of the earth, we can have that good effect upon our society. Well, next week we go on, take the next unit here of Mark's Gospel. And part of what we're going to look at next week is, I think, a very familiar and interesting passage about the rich young ruler. So we'll be going as far at least as verse 22 in Mark 10 next time. If you want to look ahead and study that interesting, valuable passage of Scripture to study.